Gilbert King's research for Devil in the Grove led him further down a trail of corruption, miscarriage of justice, and secrecy in the region. And now his new book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. It ripples with tensions over sex, race, and class. Beneath a Ruthless Sun is a true crime tale that raises themes that haunt us still today. Justice perverted by bigotry and the force of white privilege, wrongful incarceration, and the power of the free press. Again, the name of the new book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. And we welcome Gilbert King to the roundtable this morning. Gilbert, thank you very much for being with us. A pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, good morning, Joe. It's great to be back with you.
Well, give us a sense of how you came to this particular case.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was doing a book talk for Devil in the Grove back in Lake County, way back in 2012. And at the end of the talk, this elderly gentleman came up to me, and he kind of stuck his business card in my face, and it said Sheriff of Lake County. And I said, oh, boy. But then he said, you know, you got your book right, but you didn't get the whole story. There's more down here. And we started talking after that, and he told me the story of a case that he said haunted him even today. And he said it was in 1957, it was a case of a kid named Jesse Daniels who was framed for a rape that he did not commit by his sheriff's department. And he said, you know, this case, nobody's going to talk to you about this, but I can't believe nobody's ever written about this. And so I started looking into it and started researching it, and the more I learned, the more I realized, you know, this is a book in itself.
So there are some overlapping characters here, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. I mean, honestly, the last thing I really want to do is do another book involving Sheriff Willis McCall. And in fact, I started out thinking, well, maybe he'll just be a smaller character in here. But the truth of the matter is he was very involved. The more I started learning, the more he was just involved in this particular case. It's about 10 years after Devil in the Grove. And, you know, he was still undeterred by what had happened in Groveland 10 years before. And he was still involved in these injustices and these civil rights investigations that went nowhere. And so he's back, and Sheriff Willis McCall, his nemesis, Mabel Norris Reese, is also back. And so they're still going at it years later.
Okay, so it's 1957. What happened? What was the case? Where do we start off on this?
Well, I think the interesting thing is to recognize a context of what was happening. So this is like after Brown versus Board. So this is a landmark case that sort of, you know, it opened up the public schools to African Americans. Desegregation was now the law of the land. And what was really important to understand was that after that happened, there was a setback in race relations. They really deteriorated. So segregation became the number one issue in all of the South. And so you had the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. That became a much more prominent organization in the South. You had the popping up of these white citizens councils, which, you know, really Thurgood Marshall called them the Uptown Klan. It was politicians, lawyers, doctors, respectable people who were against desegregation. And so it was in this climate of post-Brown that you have this criminal case that pops up. In December of 1957, you have a wealthy white citrus baron's wife who was sexually assaulted in her home with her three children were present. And she tells police that she was assaulted by a hefty Negro with bushy hair. Those were her words. And so Sheriff Willis McCall and his men round up the usual suspects, 24 young black men, take them into jail, start questioning them, and then they finally settle on the one suspect, coincidentally the nephew of the civil rights activist in town. And so that's how the case gets started. Mabel Norris Reese suspects something very fishy, and she starts investigating.
What kind of, give us a sense, and I think we talked about this for the last book, but what given the timing of this, there are people who are still alive, who are people who still have, are telling stories. And so who were you able to talk to? Who were you not able to talk to? And what ultimately did you glean from those interviews?
Well, you know, ultimately what happened was, and here's why the story is tricky, because what ends up happening is a husband comes home from his trip and he sort of recognizes that now they have this African-American in custody. And the next thing you know, 2 days later, the black suspect is released, and they focus their attentions on Jesse Daniels, a white, mentally disabled teenager. And he is suddenly framed and sent away to a horrible mental institute for the next 14 years of his life. And so, as you can imagine, not a lot of people wanted to talk about this. The deputy who told me about the case said, no one's going to talk to you about this case because it involves very powerful people, and no one really, it's a very delicate subject matter. I ended up tracking down Jesse Daniels' lawyer in Daytona Beach, and he told me the exact same thing. He said, when I took Jesse's case back in the early 1970s, he said, I went to law school with a man from Lake County, and when he found out I took this case, he never talked to me again in my life. And so I was met with that kind of resistance. But I had spent so much time down there that I think ultimately I was able to sort of show people that I was serious and that I wasn't just trying to do a quick, you know, hit piece or anything like that. I wanted to take my time with it. And so people began to talk to me. In fact, even including the victim's family themselves, Blanche Bozenkett Knowles' brother, cousins, and her children ended up speaking to me. So I had a lot more cooperation than I really suspected that I would get from the beginning.
So once you have all of that, what are the main questions that you're looking to find answers to?
Well, I mean, there was no question in my mind, and I think the people around it, that Jesse Daniels was framed for this crime. So we kind of know the how of it, especially since the deputy, Evie Griffin, was telling me exactly how they did it. And all that was borne out by the investigations and the FBI reports later. The question I was really trying to get to solve was why. And Mabel Norris Reese was on to it, too. She couldn't really figure it out. She had her hunches. She began to think that maybe the reason Jesse Daniels was framed for this crime was because maybe it was more socially accepted for Blanche Bozenkett Knowles to have been raped by a white person rather than a black person. And so she proceeds down that line, but she was really never able to really conclusively prove it because all of these FBI reports that sort of had the answers in it were sealed, and she was never given access to them.
A big part of the story, of course, is the time that Jesse Daniels spends in the Florida State Hospital. And give us a sense of his experience there and what that tells us about mental institutions at that time and really even where we are today in that.
Yeah, I mean, what was really surprising and abhorrent to me was the way this mental institute in Florida and a lot of them around the country were being used as sort of a weapon in law enforcement. And so you would take somebody like Jesse Daniels, who was accused of a crime, and maybe you felt like he didn't have enough evidence to convict him. And so what they could do as another weapon was just say, okay, all we need is a judge's signature, and we can involuntarily commit them to a mental institute and just rule that they're insane and unable to defend themselves. So without a trial, without any lawyer, all you needed was that judge's signature. And if the judge happened to be part of that white supremacy establishment in a certain county, it was a very easy signature to get. And so if you were poor and defenseless, so somebody like Jesse Daniels, you had no way of fighting back. You know, he had nobody in his corner. His family was just stricken by poverty. His mother was a watermelon picker in town. Father was disabled and living off a very small army pension. So there's really nothing that could be done to help Jesse except for Mabel Norris Reese's reporting. When you go back and look at what was happening in these, you know, asylums, there was like 1,000 patients to every physician. So you might go years without ever seeing a doctor, getting any medical care. They would just load you up on Thorazine and just dope you into a stupor. They were doing lobotomies, shock therapy, anything to make a more docile patient base and easily controlled. And so Jesse ended up in one of these places. Here's a kid who was like sleeping with a teddy bear, and all of a sudden he's in with the most violent offenders, housed in a room with really no supervision. I mean, nothing could go right for him here.
Talk a little bit about his mother, Pearl Daniels, and the tireless work that she did to try to prove his innocence.
Yeah, I think that was one of the most fascinating parts of the story, because I didn't really know what Pearl was able to do until I got my hands on her correspondence with Mabel. And some of the things she was, you know, she couldn't get a lawyer. She could not afford a lawyer. And once this case had ended and Jesse got put away, the public defender's no longer involved. So now she's basically powerless. The only thing she can really do is lean on Mabel to keep the story in the press, but also to write letters to the governor, Leroy Collins, and to write letters to J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI. And she wrote dozens and dozens of letters to Hoover, to the point where Hoover was started writing her back. And I think she became such a nuisance in this case to free her son that J. Edgar Hoover just said, oh, fine, open up a civil rights investigation. And it was that civil rights investigation that really began to turn the tide. More and more investigators got involved. They began to find more and more evidence of a conspiracy. And that was what really re-inspired Mabel to get back involved in this case.
We talk about the interviews that you did, but as far as other research, how much of it was readily available? How much of it was very difficult to obtain? Because obviously there's a story here that is not being told on the surface.
Right, and then that was the problem, is that, you know, people wouldn't talk. So, and a lot of people had already passed away. So I would hear rumors of things, but I couldn't really confirm them. I got really two great investigative breaks in this case. One was the fact that I thought Mabel's files were completely gone. Like all her newspaper files from the year of 1958, when she was reporting this, were suspiciously missing from the libraries, both hard copies and microfilm. I don't know how that could have happened, but it's all missing from this one particular case. And so I just thought that was the end of it. There's no way to document it. And Mabel's granddaughter called me up one day and she said, you know, I was going through the attic in my mother's house, and I found this one box of files, and it looks to be all of the Jesse Daniels case, all the rough drafts of stories that she'd written. And so all of a sudden, 2 years into researching this book, I got my hands on all of Mabel's files. And that really, there was a lot of things in the correspondence that she never published that were right there on the page. The other big break I got out of the blue was someone contacted me on Facebook. And we started talking. They had read my last book. And, you know, I said, well, all of these investigative files are missing from the records. I can't find them. I filed all these Freedom of Information Act requests. And this person told me that they had the files. They kept them because they thought the case was really interesting at the time. And so now, all of a sudden, I've got all these investigations, all the agents who had gone in there, all these files that had somehow been missing because of some flood in the office now had turned up. And so all the things that people weren't really willing to tell me in person, but they were willing to tell the FBI under threat of perjury. So it was all there, these basically smoking gun documents.
You do have to wonder, I mean, this is one of the things that I kept on thinking about as I was reading the book, of how many cases are there out there like this that will sort of never be retried?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I come across a lot of them. Sometimes I come across these cases I absolutely convinced would be incredible books or incredible movies, and the stories are just so moving. But because there was never a civil rights investigation, all you really have are a couple of newspaper clips along the way, and maybe whoever's alive can tell you stories. Really, to do a kind of story like this, you need to have a civil rights investigator where agents can come in and just sort of say, you're not under investigation, but if you lie to us, you will be. And everybody tells the truth in these situations if they're not targets of investigation. That was the one thing I learned, is that all these statements that they're given are very detailed, and they usually go nowhere. A lot of these civil rights investigations don't lead to indictments, but the information is right there on the page in the reports. And so that is the missing link for a lot of these stories, because I come across them constantly, and it's just so frustrating to know that a civil rights investigation has never begun because there's no real way of documenting them.
Gilbert King's new book is Beneath a Ruthless Sun, a true story of violence, race, and justice lost and found. The book is now out, published by Riverhead Books. Gilbert, thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure, Joe. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you very much. Always good to have you on the show. Again, the name of the book, Beneath a Ruthless Sun. It's published by Riverhead Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.